Warning. This is the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, August 21st, 2019. We begin with the Indie Voices. This week's column is entitled, The Living Room. What would it mean for Durham, downtown, to really embrace the entire community? The article is written by Alexis Pauline Gumbs. She is the author of M. Archive, After the End of the World, Spill, Scenes of Black Feminist Fugitivity, and co-editor of Revolutionary Mothering, Love on the Front Lines. Her article. In 2007, when I created an all-ages community school called Eternal Summer of the Black Feminist Mind, I used the meeting space I had at hand, my living room. Over a decade of programming, night schools, potlucks, and ancestral birthday parties took place in the five homes I rented in Durham. Using my living room in this way transformed the way I lived. When I think about a mother plan for Durham, which I proposed last month in this space as an alternative to the master plans for Durham's growth, I think of what grows out of our living rooms. By using my living room as a micro-community institutional space, I followed in the tradition of under-resourced and passionate visionaries. Anna Julia Cooper, born a child in slavery in Raleigh, created a night school for adults in her living room in Washington, D.C. Janice J. Vaughn, founder of Cedar Chest, an organization for black lesbians that met in her living room in the 1990s. She told me that the duplex in the Birch Avenue neighborhood where I lived had been used for black feminist gatherings before my time. After I moved out, writer Zelda Lockhart used the same living room for her women's writing intensives. Ed Swan, founder of the L Room B&B, used a living room on Gear Street to host a range of events, including an intimate conversation with Erica Garner about police violence. But as Gear Street became trendy, the L Room moved farther from downtown. Those of us using our living rooms as community centers are addressing gaps in municipal funding. But amid gentrification, even having a living room to share is less common. Master planners think about living rooms, too, at least as a metaphor. The most recent 2017 version of the Downtown Durham Master Plan uses the term living room three times in three ways. The first, it is a premise. Quote, downtown is the living room of the entire Durham community, end quote. Later, the report notes that downtown's living room status may be under threat, suggesting the need for a broad range of economic, housing, and cultural investments that promote downtown's inclusivity. And then there's the living room within the living room. If downtown is the city's living room, public spaces serve as the living room for downtown by creating common spaces that are accessible to anyone. But when racially biased policing continues to shape how residents of color relate to downtown's supposedly equally accessible spaces, can they truly provide a living room for the whole community? As the emerging historian Danette Sharpley writes in an essay examining the racial context of her own Durham living room, in the 1930s, the year in which Durham experienced a massive boom in population and development, including the construction of my own house, they began redlining neighborhoods and undercutting the value of American African-American wealth. The strength of Black Wall Street and the cultural, financial, and educational success of Haiti were destroyed by policies including the construction of the Durham Freeway and bank practices that decided that homes in black neighborhoods were inherently less valuable than homes in white neighborhoods. The question of whose life is valuable is crucial again in the midst of Durham's current population boom. In her book Living Room, architect and black feminist poet June Jordan confronts the systemic racial violence that stands in the way of living rooms for communities of color around the world. When I read her words, I think of the work of Durham Beyond Policing. She wrote, "I need to speak about living room / where my children will grow without horror / I need to speak about living room where the men / of my family between the ages of 6 and 65 are not / marched into a roundup that leads to the grave." In June Jordan, if June Jordan were alive and living in Durham, I think she would love to be part of a mother planning session. She believed in the determining relationship between the architectural reality and the physical well-being. In her architectural plans and correspondence with colleague Buckminster Fuller in the 1960s, she imagined architecture as reparations for the ravaged peoples of Harlem, drawing plans for the interconnected sky-rise housing that included workshops to develop the creativity of all residents, to demonstrate the feasibility of beautiful and low-cost shelter integral to a comprehensively conceived new community for human beings. Could we imagine that in Durham, abundant living room for all of us? That is my hope. More soon. Now, moving to the news section, Get Out. This year, the DHA has filed 30 times more eviction cases than its Raleigh counterpart. Now, it's promising reform. On Monday, following revelations last week that the Durham Housing Authority had filed 540 eviction cases in the first 6 months of 2019, compared to 18 filed in the same time frame by its Raleigh counterpart, according to a legal aid attorney, the agency promised reforms. For the 6 months of this year, the DHA filing rate has been triple that of 2016 and 30 times higher than the Raleigh Housing Authority's filing rate for the same six-month period. That from Peter Gilbert, supervising attorney of Durham's Eviction Diversion Program. He wrote that in a July 10th letter to Dan Hudgens, who chairs the DHA's Board of Commissioners. Of those 540 proceedings, 20% have been for non-payment of the DHA's $50 minimum monthly rent, says Sarah D'Amato, an attorney with legal aid of North Carolina's Durham office. And most of those facing eviction are single black women. That stands to reason. A majority of the families who rely on the DHA for housing are headed by a single black woman. The average DHA tenant makes about $13,000 a year, Hudgens says, and more than 90% are black. 82% are families, most led by single women. Hudgens says board members raised the eviction issue with Anthony Scott, the DHA CEO, on July 10th. While only a small number of public housing residents facing eviction were actually removed from their homes, Scott agreed that changes need to be made. Among the reforms the agency announced last week, having the DHA's general counsel review the tenant's case before filing for eviction, partnering with the city's eviction diversion program to help at-risk families, creating hardship exemptions and alternative means for tenants to pay their rent, and training DHA staffers to guide tenants facing eviction to resources offered by county social services. Scott, who said in a press release that the comprehensive changes were made after meeting with our tenants and community housing advocates, could not be reached for comment. The reforms took effect on August 12th. Already, the DHA appears to be slowing the rate at which it seeks eviction. Of the 47 eviction cases filed in Durham County this month, only one came from the DHA. In that case, a resident at McDougal Terrace had been ordered to leave because her juvenile son was charged with shooting another child in the eye with a BB pistol. Still, Nutrenda Sumter is not impressed. For the last 7 years, Sumter, a disabled African-American woman, has paid $214 a month to live in DHA apartments. But in February, the DHA filed to evict her, claiming that Sumter only had partial payments toward her monthly rent of $679 for December and January. The problem is that the DHA has not recertified Sumter's housing voucher, which covers the gap between her income and a property's fair market value. Without that certification, Sumter was on the hook for the whole $679, though she kept paying $214. Diamoto, Sumter's attorney, says the DHA delayed her voucher recertification because the authorities said Sumter did not present up-to-date bank statements. Multiple DHA officials did not respond to requests for comment about her case. In February, a court threw out the DHA's case. According to Yamoto, the authority failed to notify Sumter that her voucher hadn't been recertified. She knows now. But on Diamato's advice, she's still paying $214 a month. She can't afford to pay more, she said. The DHA hasn't tried to evict her again, but it also hasn't settled the certification problem. On May 9th, it sent her a letter informing her that she had 14 days to vacate the premises. 2 days before the deadline, she received a note telling her that she had an outstanding balance of more than $3,800. 3 months later, the balance is now more than $5,000. Sumter says a previous DHA apartment on Glasson Street was infested with black mold. While living there, she was diagnosed with a weakened heart complicated by breathing problems. She also says that DHA maintenance workers didn't unclog her bathroom sink and tub, and she had to wear mud boots to stand in the shower. I didn't get sick until I moved in that building, Sumter said. You got people drinking mold, eating mold, and you are charging them rent. They're just sitting on that balance, and it's looming over her head, not knowing what they're going to do, Diamoto said. If they try to evict her, we will bring up these issues. While her client isn't optimistic that the DHA's reforms will amount to much, Diamoto calls them a step in the right direction. Other housing advocates agree. Charles Holton, the director of the Civil Justice Clinic with the Duke School of Law, helped establish a pilot eviction diversion program at the university in 2017. We look forward to working with the DHA to reduce the number of evictions, he said, which are a blight on our entire community. Our next article is this week's feature story, Who Are Raleigh's Real Progressives? By Lee Taus. Almost everyone running for office in Raleigh claims to be a progressive, but they define that word differently. Which version wins will shape the city's future. On July 2nd, at the Raleigh City Council's last meeting before its summer break, a handful of residents stepped forward to oppose a rezoning request that might eventually allow developer John Kane to build downtown's tallest skyscraper on the site of Peace Street, currently zoned for 12 stories. Their complaints boiled down to the idea that the project was too much, too tall, too intense, too many transient renters, as one put it. Most important, too much traffic. One woman with cropped white hair and thick-rimmed glasses called a plan to add a bike lane to the project almost offensive. She didn't elaborate. Bob Geary, who cast a sole vote against the rezoning as a member of the city zoning commission, told the council that Zane's building, in a thriving part of town abutting the nightlife district, would do nothing to eliminate gentrification or benefit the city's poor, so it should be rejected. If you ask him, Geary, a former indie writer, will tell you he's the most progressive person he knows. Most of the PD who objected to Kane's development would call themselves progressives, too. In their eyes, they're standing up to an avaricious developer who is remaking the character of downtown, clogging its streets and turning it into a playground for the elite. Kane's offer to put $1 million into the city's Affordable Housing Trust Fund is woefully insufficient, they say, considering that he hasn't committed to reserving units in his building for lower-income people. If they had their way, if the state law didn't prohibit it, they'd require developers to include affordable housing in their projects, especially as a condition for higher intensity zoning. But many other people who also call themselves progressives think Kane's project is a good thing, and the council should stay out of the way. They want downtown to get taller and busier, rather than having development sprawl toward the suburbs. They want more bike lanes and bikes, and fewer cars, and even electric scooters. In short, they want Raleigh to embrace the big city it could become rather than pine for the sleepy town it used to be. And they believe the way to address the city's affordability crisis isn't by going to war with the developers, but by asking them to build more, a lot more. They want the neighborhoods surrounding the city's core to become denser by adding duplexes, triplexes, and accessory dwelling units where city rules currently allow only single-family homes. That's how you build a greener city centered more on mass transit and less on cars, they say. But these types of changes are anathema to the first camp, whose proponents can be protective of the character of their single-family neighborhoods, annoyed by the prospect of slow-going commutes, and see the second camp as selling out to a moneyed development interest. These dueling perspectives are often labeled NIMBY and YIMBY, though that's probably reductive. That's not in my neighborhood, backyard, and yes, in my backyard. You could also point to a generational divide at work, with younger residents least fearful of urban development, though this characterization likewise runs the risk of being overly simplistic. Each group believes it is espousing smart growth principles that will prevent Raleigh from repeating the mistakes made by other fast-growing cities, such as Austin and Seattle. And each group also believes that its positions are truly progressive, more progressive than the others. Broadly speaking, defining yourself as a progressive in terms of national politics is easy. You're for equality, social justice, universal health care, a robust safety net, and initiative to combat climate change. You're also unlikely to own a MAGA hat. Locally, things aren't so cut and dried. Almost everyone running for Raleigh mayor and city council is a Democrat. Almost all identify as progressive. But on the thorniest issues facing the city, growth, development, affordability, the council's current majority and those seeking to oust them stake out starkly different territory. On one side are the pro-neighborhood incumbents, the Council of No, as their detractors call them, David Cox, Steph Mandel, Russ Stevenson, and Kay Crowder. They're skeptical, not only of developers and density, but of Airbnb and e-scooters. They're also all white, all over 60, and all homeowners. Three of the four are retired. Nicole Stewart, who at 38 is the council's younger member, defines progressives the other way. She sees growth as inevitable, and urban infill as a positive force. Corey Branch, the 41-year-old mayor pro tem and the council's only African American, usually leans in that direction, too. This October, they'll be joined on the ballot by more than a dozen challengers seeking to oust the pro-neighborhood incumbents, many of whom are like-minded, development-friendly millennials who also call themselves progressives. The question facing Raleigh voters isn't whether they want a progressive government. It's what kind of progressive government they prefer. Their answer will shape the city's future. Here's how the dictionary defines progressive. A person advocating or implementing social reform or new liberal ideas. Here's how Mayor Nancy McFarland defines it. Urban progressives understand that a city is a changing, morphing entity, and our job to put all those things in place that define what kind of city we want it to be, said McFarland, who announced in March that she isn't seeking re-election. Urban conservatives are people that don't want anything to change. Case in point, when former council member Marianne Baldwin, the vice president of marketing at a construction company, who is decidedly in the Build More camp, announced a bid to succeed McFarland, she said she was doing so to advance a bold progressive vision for the city. Her critics scoffed. How could she claim to be progressive when she's so close to builders? Nowhere have the battle lines over development been more sharply drawn than in the rich enclaves of the reliably liberal California, where a lack of housing supply has driven the price of even modest homes into the stratosphere. In 2018, California lawmakers introduced legislation to encourage density along mass transit corridors by reducing local zoning authority. Under resistance from coalitions of homeowners who called the bill a handout to developers and said it threatened neighborhoods' character, however, the bill died. The larger issue is that too many Democrats have given a misguided, knee-jerk defense of the restrictive zoning policies that have perpetrated the urban housing crisis. New York columnist Jonathan Chait responded, in parentheses, worth noting, Shade's critics often deride him as an insufficiently progressive neoliberal. Close parentheses. These kinds of zoning policies exist in Raleigh, too, and are legacies of segregation, as housing policy expert Richard Rothstein explains in his 2017 book, The Color of Law. Nearly a century ago, the city's school system located the black schools into southeast Raleigh, near a quarry and a landfill, which quickly concentrated the city's black population there. After World War II, as whites were lured to the suburbs, government policies blocked many black families from obtaining mortgages. In Raleigh, home buying trends exacerbated economic and racial segregation in neighborhood, says Asa Fleming, president of the North Carolina Association of Realtors. North Hills and Five Points flourished with investments in new single-family homes, while the areas around traditionally Black Shaw and St. Augustine's universities deteriorated. Compounding the disparity, white families were more likely to sell their homes every 10 years, accumulating wealth and driving up prices in their neighborhoods, while black owners stayed put. North Raleigh is traditionally where the white families were buying and settling in and moving out from the cities, Fleming said. Most of the black families were compartmentalized down in the south. Their urban neighborhoods were left to languish, often at the mercy of negligent landlords. In the last two decades, the script has flipped, and so have a lot of houses in these once undesirable neighborhoods. Downtown, including in Raleigh, have become hip again, and developers began turning their attention to the long-overlooked neighborhoods nearby. Formerly, affordable bungalows were torn down and replaced with bigger, gaudier houses that fill up an entire lot and start at $500,000, and families once forced to live there are now being elbowed out. Progressives generally agree that gentrification is bad. In Raleigh, the development skeptical cohort tends to think that preserving these existing neighborhoods as well as existing neighborhoods throughout the city should be the city's goal. But preservation has a convenient side effect. The wealthier single-family neighborhoods in West Raleigh, the ones with political clout, stay the same, too, which means no apartment complexes or townhouses dilute the inflating value of their split levels. It's supply and demand. Each year, about 24,000 people move to Wake County, but only about 10 to 12,000 new housing units get built. That drives up home prices. The Build Now group says the answer is to work with developers, not against them. They point out that increased housing supply has led to stabilized or even falling market rate rents in Nashville, Portland, Seattle, and Washington, D.C. But this will mean changing the city's rules to encourage denser forms of housing: duplexes, triplexes, quads, backyard cottages, tiny homes, cottage courts, and so on. The pro-neighborhood camp, which has controlled the council since 2017, hasn't been keen on this idea. Instead, it often seems more intent on micromanaging development, including what people can build on their own property. In February, it passed an ordinance requiring homeowners who want to build an accessory dwelling unit to first get their neighbor's permission. Even more restrictive are neighborhood conservation overlay districts, which aim to preserve and enhance the general quality and appearance of established neighborhoods by regulating built environmental characteristics such as lot size and frontage, building setback, and building height. The city has 20 NCODs, with two more pending review for comparison. Meanwhile, Durham has two, each freezing its slice of Raleigh in time. Raleigh's latest NCOD application is for Cameron Village, where modest homes are already priced at more than $450,000. The council was set to hear an update on Cameron Village application, as well as consider an NCOD request from Willow South Run on Tuesday after the Indy goes to press. The message these districts broadcast is clear. If the city must grow, it shouldn't be here. In 1970, Joni Mitchell famously sang about a paving paradise and putting up a parking lot. A half century later, that sentiment that develops its destructive still resonates among boomer liberals. They've seen greed wreak havoc on the environment. A year before Big Yellow Taxi was released, the Cayuga River in Cleveland caught fire. Into the 90s, major U.S. cities were choked by smog. Humans punched a hole in the ozone layer and may yet eradicate ourselves through climate change. All the while, developers have clear-cut forests and filled in wetlands to make way for endless stretches of tract homes in the hinterlands. Housing projects often named for the trees they felled, fed by massive arteries of pavement, literally paving paradise. If development stands in opposition to the environment, building a true progressive means being skeptical of developers. And if growth requires more development, then it's something to be as skeptical of, too. As Councilmember David Koch writes on his website, Raleigh is a rapidly growing city. The big question is, what will the city be like in 10 or 20 years? Will it continue to offer the same high quality of life that we take for granted today? Cox, who did not respond to the Indy's request for an interview, got his start in local politics by opposing a proposed supermarket in the North Raleigh in 2014. His implication is that unchecked growth will inexorably make residents' lives miserable. During his 4 years in office, he's made clear that he sees his job as ensuring that this doesn't happen. That makes him a real progressive, says Donna Bailey, who chairs the Hillsborough Wake Citizens Advisory Council. For too long, she said, developers have been too powerful. The council's majority, Cox, along with Mindell, Stevenson, Crowder, and the retiring Dixie Thompson, are all that's keeping them at bay and maintaining a balance between growth and neighborhood. I'm a very liberal, definitely a progressive Democrat, she said, but I also know that doesn't mean you just throw away the neighborhoods. The pro-neighborhood coalition talks about balance, but its arguments are frequently framed in black and white terms. Paradise or parking lots? Neighborhoods or development? But things aren't that simple. People are coming. The city's housing crisis is getting worse. Where should they all go? All over, Bailey said. There's room to be developed. That's as specific as she gets. Ask the same question, Bob Geary points to the failing strip malls lining Capitol Boulevard and Wake Forest Road north of downtown. We have many opportunities to redevelop those old shopping centers as dense housing, and they're on major transit corridors, says Geary, who lives in Cameron Park. Better there, he continues, than in the city's core. Raleigh's success as a city is predicated on strong neighborhoods, and especially strong neighborhoods inside the Beltline. It really won't really do to grow in a way that undermines the stability and the desirability of neighborhoods that are well established. This idea hits upon practical limitations. The city can't force the property owners to redevelop their land. And if it made economic sense to turn them into housing complexes, someone would have done it, which means if there's no market for housing, the city would likely have to buy the land or subsidize any housing built out there. Cox, meanwhile, has argued that because neighborhoods suffer from poor development decisions, residences should have a say in what happens in their neighborhoods, a veto, like he and his neighborhoods, exercised with that supermarket. The problem with this theory is twofold. One, this kind of hyper-local decision-making can be provincial, with the desires of the few being prioritized over the needs of the many. Two, not every resident can always participate. Young families with kids, for instance, can't always make it to CAC meetings, which means attendance may not be representative of the neighborhood. The result is a series of decisions based on loud but not necessarily widespread neighborhood opposition to projects. Take the Oxford Road sidewalk, which the city spent 5 years and more than $20,000 planning before Steph Mindell spiked it earlier this year, after hearing from a few upset residents and assuming the whole neighborhood thought the same way. But that wasn't the case, and Mindell eventually reversed course. Her opponent, David Knight, says frustration over that episode drove him into the race. A similar thing happened in February when Cox tried to redirect $2 million in funds from Riverbend Park to another park project. He, too, had listened to a few and thought they spoke for the many. When families who wanted that money to go to Riverbend Park pushed back, he relented, admitting, "I frankly screwed up this time." Brian Fitzsimmons says that screw-up was the straw that broke the camel's back, the reason he decided to challenge Cox. If our priority is protecting our neighborhoods, said Nicole Stewart, then what that means right now is protecting the way of life for those who are there already. If our priority is making sure our people have the housing they need, then it means that our neighborhoods are going to change. And that's not a bad thing. This is the mantra you hear from pro-growth progressive: walkable neighborhoods, downtown density, alternative transportation options. They want a bank to bike to work. They want to walk to an urban park. They don't mind tall buildings that bring more people and commerce downtown. And they realize that without changing the city's zoning template, a lot of that can't happen. If you are not pro-density, then you aren't an urban progressive, says Trophy Brewing co-owner David Meeker. Editors note Meeker's uncle, Richard Meeker, owns the Indy. Some of these conversations are hard. The green way to grow is up, and there's going to be density coming up on these older neighborhoods. It is what it is. Just as Donna Bailey believes the council's true progressives are the ones fighting developers, the wave of pro-density challengers say the pro-neighborhood clique doesn't deserve that title. I feel that progressiveness in Raleigh is not real, says mayoral candidate Zani Balok. We think it's real. We think we're progressive. But in reality, we are a very conservative city. Our politics are very conservative. We're not doing anything innovative. We're not taking any risks. We're just doing the bare minimum. What's the difference between having this council in office and a bunch of Republicans? Even Corey Branch, who tends to stay out of these fights, admits, I think as a city, we're not progressive. When it comes to their neighborhood, people are nervous. They're scared. I think that's the reason we have so many NCODs that come up. That's why we have pushed back on housing heights and things of that nature. Marianne Baldwin said she wants to diversify the city's housing stock and add density. Council candidates like Sage Martin and Brittany Bryan, who are challenging Kay Crowder in District 3, say the city may need to disrupt some neighborhoods to make room for newcomers. Belloc goes further. She wants to get rid of single-family zoning, which she says has created to segregate cities, as Minneapolis and the state of Oregon have done in the last year. Their laws allow duplexes or triplexes in neighborhoods that before allowed only single-family houses in an effort to combat rising housing costs and the racial wealth gap. Minneapolis has long been a progressive city, says Richard Florida, an economic and professor of urban studies at the University of Toronto. It's a city that has long taken inequality seriously. While eliminating single family is a Yimba posture, it's not a single thrust, he adds. It's knitted together with a broader focus on inequality. Minneapolis's plan, adopted in December, also addresses access to employment, quality of life, walkability, public transportation, and public safety. In addition, it will require developers to set aside at least 10% of large projects for low-income residents, a process known as inclusionary zoning. Building more housing is a necessary but insufficient condition, Florida said. In other words, cities have to build more. NIMBYs missed the mark by focusing on restricting development, he argues, but that alone won't be a panacea to the housing crisis. They also need to build dedicated affordable housing. While Raleigh council members have spoken about the urgency of the city's affordability crisis, they declined to put a housing bond on the ballot this year, as Durham did. They're likely to do so in 2020 instead. Florida suggests following New York City's model, which requires developers to include affordability components in their projects or pay a fee. But since inclusionary zoning is prohibited by North Carolina law, he also says cities need to take a more holistic approach. They need to focus on creating better jobs and raising the minimum wage so that more people who work in the city can afford to live there. Here again, raising the minimum wage is also prohibited by North Carolina law. But Wake County did pass a $2.3 billion referendum in 2016 to improve its mass transit system, which Florida says is another key piece of the puzzle. Ultimately, however, there is no one-size-fits-all approach. My hunch is every city will do it differently, Florida says. Every city will tailor it to its own needs. Some will do more wage improvement. Some will build more housing. Some will do it more market-based. And some will do it more public-based. But out of this, we're going to learn how to do it. Our next article, Ode to Joyero. The other half of Wee Oak finds his voice in solitude. As we careen toward a dystopian world of crowds and noise, there are few better places to be alone with one's brain than Marfa. The tiny West Texas town has become an unlikely haven for artists, musicians, and abstract thinkers, not only because of its desolate natural beauty, but also because of its almost supernatural isolation from pretty much everywhere else. American urban hubs are increasingly augmented by bucolic townships, perfect for quick little bouts of creating before returning to city life. But in Marfa, there's no city to go back to. You are really far away from everyone, just you and the cleansing enormity of desert and sky. For Andy Stack, composer, working drummer, musical polymath, and Dream Team bandmate, Marfa was not just a place to live and work, but a liminal slice of space-time in which to be alone and finally make his own record, Release the Dogs, recorded under the name of Joyero, which Merg Records will release on August the 23rd. "It's just totally this island," Stack says of Marfa. "I was pretty isolated." That's kind of what this record came out of. Like the meticulous drummer he is, Stack was precisely on time for our coffee meeting on an absurdly hot day in Durham, his home for the last 18 months. You likely know Stack as half of Wee Oak, but he's also the touring drummer for the indie supergroup LV and the beloved Merge band Lamb Chop. And he brings precision and skill to an ever-expanding roster of musicians, including Aledro Negro and Thor Harris. When accused of being a serial collaborator, Slack reflects on his experience as a semi-recent arrival to Durham. In comparison to a Baltimore scene driven by art school mystique, the Triangle feels like an open, welcoming exercise in mutual inspiration and admiration. It's been a really positive experience moving here and being exposed to the community, which is extremely unpretentious, very earnest, and dedicated to musicianship and craft in a way that's really refreshing, he said. "I'm playing with people who I feel elevate me, making adventurous music. But it's not my music, so I can release the anxiety of how are people going to receive this?" When he's not helping his peers process their musical instincts, Stack composes music for television and film, a more solitary enterprise, but one that's nonetheless beholden to something beyond his own vision. "It's still a creative application," Stack said, "but you have to work at it from a much more logical and less egocentric place. It's a weird thing because you're a technician that's in service to the emotional pull of the piece that you're doing. But there's no one else to fall back on in the deserts of West Texas. Without a squadron of colleagues and collaborators, Stack has to rely on his own ideas and instincts to create projects that felt vital to him, one of which was Joyero. I think the isolation and the solitude make me get in touch with some versions of my musicianship and my creative self that I could have continued to brush off," he said. "It's kind of ironic that somebody in a two-person band would want to trim down even more. But I think it's really nice to be able to be on my own." That two-person band would, of course, be Wee Oak, one of the most nimble and imaginative groups around. If you've seen the Baltimore-bred Durham-based duo, you know Stack's calm, confident presence, drumming with one hand, triggering a multiverse of tweezed and pre-processed sonic wonder with the other, creating a finely layered space inhabited by Jen Wasner's potent, inevitable voice and guitar. Even behind the incandescent Wasner, Stack is a fascinating thing to watch, constantly multitasking, coolly in control of his gear. The pair has developed an almost psychic ability to communicate, which Wasner calls musical shorthand. He's the ideal collaborator, Wozner said. Versatile and egoless. He can play pretty much anything he can get his hands on, and he's willing to take notes and work together to find the part that's right for the song. This precision is all over Release the Dogs, as are on the mutable colors of Stack's playing. On Alight, the opener, it takes Stack just under 90 seconds to do the following introduce an insistent doubly drum and bass pattern, tweak his tempo, add an organ zimbullion hum, crank up the delay, push the whole thing toward oblivion, gently pull it back from the brink, and introduce us to his voice with the lilting couplet, "I told you I wanted to be a part of it." If this sounds like a frantic beginning, somehow it's not. It's exhilarating, but controlled, even when the only thing keeping it from slipping into chaos is Stack's softly commanding voice, the quietest aspect of Release the Dogs, but arguably the most captivating. "I lost this fledgling version of myself as a singer," Stack said. "Making this record was a process of discovery from the emotional connection to singing and the pure physicality of singing. That process leads to some haunting places. Lyrically, the record is contemplative, with moments of ache and sadness. On first single, Dogs, the chorus paints a picture of lonesome aimlessness. While you're away, I wait outside the house. Lift an ear to every sound. I sleep all day like a dog whose master's out. I don't know up from down." Talking to Stack, I struggle to find an appropriate word for his rare lyrics, so he does it for me, breezily describing some of the album's thematic material as dark, but sonically it's marked by moments of ferocious, effervescent joy. On Steepest Stairs, a warbling keyboard suddenly erupts into arcs of melody that seem to ascend endlessly. The energy is thrilling, woozy, and romantic. Cut through again by Stack's voice, gently assertive and steadily intoning. "And the hours will pass with your breath on the glass, looking in on the last of the old dream." The layers drop out suddenly for the swooning chorus, which only makes their prismatic return more triumphant. Durham musician Jay Hammond, a.k.a. Trippers and Asker, is Stack's former Berklee School of Music classmate. They reconnected in Durham and started improvising together, picking up a musical relationship that had left off 10 years before. Even after playing with Stack, Hammond was struck by the complexity of Joyero, amazed that it was the work of one person. "But the thing that's not surprising to me is just that it's very beautiful," Hammond said. "It's very tender, very sincere music." "To be both intimate and expansive at the same time is a tough one," Stack said, "but it can be definitely done." For him, the record's lyrical and musical juxtapositions are about capturing feelings of ambivalence. Ambivalent might seem like an odd way to describe such a vivid record, but it makes more sense the more you listen to it. Spinning Steepest Stairs for the 10th time during the heat-induced psychedelia of a run through Durham's back streets, I can hear what Stack meant. It's an ambivalence born not of apathy, but of experience, that calm that comes when you find yourself in the desert with no one to record with, making peace with the fact that you're just going to have to do it yourself. Joyero is about to go on the road, an enterprise that naturally has become informed by Stack's penchant for collaboration. On a recent tour with multi-instrumentalist Thor Harris's group, Thor and Friends, Stack ended up sitting in on saxophone with his tour mates. "I just totally fell back in love with saxophone, which I played in school and then didn't touch it for like 10 years, he said. He pauses as I grapple with the fact that he also plays the saxophone alongside the 600 other things he seems to have mastered. I'm not like the guy who's going to rip some jazz lick, he says with a laugh, but I really enjoyed playing it. He's incorporated the instrument in Joyero's live set, where it meets an electronic processing engine, which Stack affectionately calls the meat grinder, and ends up creating those synthetic textures out of organic materials. That place where the digital meets the acoustic, and where creating alone melds into creating with others, is at the crux of where we find Andy Stack on Joyero and where he finds himself. It's a work in progress, he tells me, with playing solemnity, on many levels. We now turn to the indie food section. Eating words. In the world of immersive underground dining, food becomes storytelling. Underground pop-up dining has become ubiquitous in global food culture. The former Starry Kitchen, which began in the tiny apartment of Nguyen and Tri Tan in Los Angeles, led to global recognition and a cookbook deal. In Buenos Aires, the low-risk restaurants operated out of chefs' homes called Puertas Cerradas, Spanish for closed doors, are one of Argentina's best-kept secrets. Some underground pop-ups began as hobbies, accepting only donations. Some are born out of necessity in a struggling economy. Many also come at a high price, catering one-of-a-kind experiences for the elite. Underground dining might be inextricably linked with the allure of being part of a secret society, but it's also about the pleasure of coming together with strangers to share a good meal and a good story. Going out to eat, and as good as the food can be, can oftentimes feel like a shallow experience, says Jacob Bohm, executive chef and owner of Snap Pea Catering in Chapel Hill, which has offered conceptual pop-up dinners for 5 years on secret locations around the Triangle. Over 9 to 12 courses, Bohm creates each dish to drive out the narratives of the food in the location, which is revealed 36 hours before the event. There was last summer's Saturn-inspired course at Moorhead Planetarium, the Science Center in Chapel Hill, and the banquet dinner at The Fruit in Durham, an immersive theatrical feast accompanied by a performance of Macbeth, kind of like Sleep No More, but with food you ate with your hands. There was a dinner at the Butterfly House at Durham's Museum of Life and Science at one of the old Bynum Bridge above the Haw River. It's so crazy to see 124 people breaking bread together at a single table, Bohm said. Every detail, from each locally sourced seasonal ingredient to the wine, flowers, table settings, and other decor, is tailored to the theme of each dinner's story. Sometimes a dish will make a pun. Other times, a key ingredient ties in an historical reference. Bohm says his events not only teach guests about where the food came from, but also connects them to a larger story about where they're eating it. At Raleigh Denim, guests learned about the process of making a pair of jeans, from growing cotton to manufacturing to shop display. In the former St. Agnes Hospital, which was the only fully equipped African-American hospital in the South in the 1920s, Bohm crafted individual palmzana by layering local heirloom potatoes dug up within 25 miles of St. Agnes, as was the stone it's built from. Snap Peas events are wildly popular. Its 57th pop-up, which is currently running for 3 weekends, is called The Affair of the Stasi Meisterwerk. The event, a murder mystery co-produced with Clay Thomas, a writer in Chattanooga, sold out in 90 seconds at about $200 a head. Each guest has been assigned a character and asked to arrive in full costume. In addition to other homegrown pop-ups that have come and gone, such as The Blind Pig, formerly of Asheville, will begin operations in the Triangle this fall. And Raleigh's Chicken Wire, the area also sometimes attracts them from other places. Underground Kitchen is a Richmond-based traveling experimental fine dining company featuring award-winning chefs like New York City's Giovanna Della Campagna and Jay Ponder of Food Network's Chopped and Cutthroat Kitchen. It returns to Raleigh this weekend at a soon-be-disclosed location for $150 a ticket. Underground Kitchen has hosted a dozen of these dinners in Raleigh, unearthed in 2016 at the now-defunct Cave, 1912, and Luxury, Ruffled by Truffles, in 2018 at City Market. And it also held a recent dinner at the James Beard Foundation. Much like Snap Pea Catering, Underground Kitchen emphasizes storytelling, diving into the origins of the food and exploring where it's farmed, who's doing the farming, and whether those practices are sustainable. Each ingredient is to be locally sourced to the surrounding area as it can be. Underground Kitchen has traveled all along the Eastern Corridor and recently expanded into the Northeast. Its current tour, the North Americana, showcases not just the food, farmers, and artisans, but also the personal stories of the up-and-coming chefs on board, such as Raleigh's Caribbean-born Lamar Farrington, who will cook this weekend. Founder and CEO Michael Sparks says that since the very beginning, Underground Kitchen has stayed within its margins to keep businesses financially sustainable. "We make sure it's worth the go into each market," Sparks says. "Things to be made to travel well and be cost efficient. It's like a restaurant on wheels." Sparks, a former fashion designer from New York, started Underground Kitchens in his Richmond home with his partner, Benjamin Brown, as a way to connect with their community. "As an interracial gay couple, we were sort of shunned by the neighborhood, like any gay New Yorkers would have been," he said. "So we started throwing dinner parties and brought neighbors together who had never met each other before." "You're coming together with this group of 20 to 60 like-minded people that may not have the same views, but everyone is on the same page," she says. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program had been intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder, this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.